Your Holiness, welcome to the third day of our meeting. How was your sleep last night? How many hours?
All of it is 9 hours.
9 hours, wonderful.
About 6. Sleep. Then 3:30 morning, wake up. Some meditation. I may sort of share one sort of joke. Last year, on my visit within India, then one BJP was a leader company with me. So then, within, I think, four days, we become very close friend. So then, one day morning, he asked me, how your sleep or rest? Then I mentioned, no problem. Always 9 hours sleep, and then 3-4 hours meditation. So that's sharpening my mind, so I can cheat other people very easily. then his response, very nice, spontaneously. Oh, he sleep only 6 hours. He cannot cheat other people. Very nice, isn't it? Very spontaneous. Yes.
So, Your Holiness, we began our meeting on the first day with a consideration of basic science that underlies some of the qualities that are cultivated in social, emotional, and ethical learning that we have been considering. Yesterday, we saw examples of a number of different programs that have been developed inspired by your writings and your thinking on social emotional learning and the teaching of secular ethics. And one of the characteristics of those programs is that they include many, many different elements. And from a scientific perspective, that represents what we think of as a very complex intervention. And so one of the things that we scientists like to do, as we mentioned yesterday, is to consider what may be the active ingredients in these programs. What are the key...
이게 개체적으로 가르친 방법은 제가 들어보죠. 근데 로전도 옐라베가블이야 차지하면 무지 상고로 템바대야다 시신송해야다.
So what are the key components? And over the next 2 days, we're going to be taking a deeper look at some of those key components. And today, we will be focused on the topics of attention and meta-awareness. Now, attention, I think we all have some sense of, although we'll, I'm sure, have some discussion about different kinds of attention. But what is meta-awareness? One way that we think of meta-awareness in scientific contexts, one of the ways in which it's been measured, and also something that I think many of us have had the experience of, is when we're reading a book, we can be attentive to the words and know the words that we're reading, but our minds could be lost. Our minds could be wandering. This happens maybe not with Your Holiness, but I could tell you that in the United States...
Same experience.
Well, there's scientific data showing that at least in the United States, on average, the average American adult spends 47% of his or her waking life actually not paying attention to what they're doing. They're lost. And so at the moment we come back, at the moment we remember, at the moment we recognize that that we have been lost, that is a moment of meta-awareness. And it represents a kind of monitoring function of the mind. And so we are going to be addressing that in several different ways. Amishi Jha from the University of Miami will be discussing this in basic research contexts. Sona Demijian from the University of Colorado in Boulder will be discussing this in how it's applied in clinical contexts, where studies of patients with depression, for example, have been examined. And then wonderful Buddhist scholar who you're well acquainted with, whose boss is sitting here, where's Sophie? Jinpa La will be giving us a Buddhist perspective on meta-awareness. So that is what we have in store for us today. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Amishi.
Good morning, Your Holiness. It's a great honor and privilege to be with you here today. I was actually born in India, in the state of Gujarat, in the city of Ahmedabad, very near Gandhiji's ashram. But I was raised in the West and trained in the United States as a neuroscientist. And the work in my laboratory focuses on understanding how the brain pays attention and what the basic mechanisms are of attention. And as Richie just described, you know, over the last few days, we've had the opportunity to hear about social, emotional, and ethical learning. And you've spoken about educating the heart. And one suggestion I'd like us to consider today in our conversation is regarding the importance of attention and meta-awareness for these functions of self-regulation and self-awareness. So what I'd like to do is give you a sense of where I come from the Western cognitive psychological perspective, and have a rich discussion on learning together and discussing with you where there may be an overlap between Buddhist perspectives and our Western perspectives on these topics. And as Richie already mentioned, so Richie mentioned this very common example of wanting to read a book. And I always think of this in the context of learning and education, of a child wanting to read a book, having the dedicated intention of reading a book. And he may be sitting there reading it and very easily able to comprehend the words on the page. And at some point, he may reach the bottom of the page and come to the understanding that he has not understood the words. And in that moment, he may probe, as Richie mentioned, where his mind was, and may realize, oh, I wasn't actually reading. I was thinking about some personal preoccupation. And I'd like to just take this very common example and describe it in the terms that we use from this psychological perspective of attention and meta-awareness. So when we use this term attention, I'm specifically talking about voluntarily and with a commitment to doing so, engaging our mental resources in a particular object. In this case, the book. At some point, the child has realized that his attention has shifted away. But let's not even talk about his realization of that. At some point, the attention has shifted away from that chosen object. And we call that, and I want to be kind of technical here, we call that mind wandering. So this is having an off-task thought during an ongoing task or activity. It's not simply just daydreaming. It's having a dedicated focus you'd like to have and having your attention pulled away from that. Then in the moment that he realizes that this has happened, we, as Richie already mentioned, call that meta-awareness, the explicit awareness that of what the current contents of our conscious experience are, right? Now, what happens once he's come to this realization that his mind has wandered and he's very aware it's wandered to some other content? At that point, he would actively decide to re-engage his attention on the chosen object. And what I'd like to do is talk through all of these different processes and understand...
the metals of the shiver but never chica metaphysics and the shiver 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 shiver.
So it's not the ordinary conscious experience, it's the awareness of the conscious experience, of what is in our current mental contents. All right. So I'd like to go through all three of these things. What are the mechanisms of attention? And in particular, how does attention impact our sensory perception at the earliest stages of engaging with something in the world? How does it impact us? What are the costs of mind wandering? And when I'm speaking about mind wandering here in terms of costs, what damage does it do in terms of our ability to behave in the world? What harmful effects might it have when our attention has been pulled away by something else? And then we'll talk about what meta-awareness is and how we're using our technologies to actually understand this. And this is where I would really ask for your advice and input, because we have very little sophistication on this topic right now. So let's begin by talking about attention. And I'm giving this formal kind of definition here. Again, I want to emphasize this is voluntary attention. And what we say is that this allows, attention allows for the selection out of all the many things in the world, the selection of a chosen object, and there's preferential processing of that information. Oops, sorry about that. Preferential processing of that object over irrelevant or distracting information. And the reason I have this image of a flashlight here is because that really is the metaphor we use in psychology of what we mean by attention. Just as... So I'll just elaborate on what I mean by that. So just as if we were in a darkened room, wherever we direct that flashlight, we'll have privileged information, higher quality information about what we are illuminating, right? And just like a flashlight, we can move it around to different parts of the visual scene, visual space. We can also have it very broad or narrow. But the flashlight metaphor really stops because we're not only able to dedicate it to the external environment, but we can point it internally to our own memories, thoughts, and sensations. And just like the external environment, when we point that flashlight internally, whatever it is that we point to will be what is heightened in our conscious experience. So unfortunately, that means if we point that flashlight to negative thoughts, to angry thoughts, that will be most prominent in our conscious experience. So I want to give you a sense. I would love it if you could travel to my laboratory and see my lab, but since we're here in India, I thought I'd bring a little bit of the laboratory to you to give you a sense of how we actually study the impact of attention on perception in the lab. So this is an example of a very common kind of experiment that we do. And again, the intention here is to see how attention impacts sensory perception. We would show our participants a series of images like this. And Your Holiness, I hope you can see there's both a face and a house. I think the resolution's okay. So what we would do is present a series of these overlaid images, one after another. And for some period of time, we'd tell our participant, for this period of time, only pay attention to the face. And to make sure that they're doing so, we ask them to tell us if the face was male or female. So they just press a button saying male or female. That tells us they're appropriately attending to the face. Or we say, disregard the face, pay attention to the scene. Is it indoor or outdoor? Right? So the key is that they're deciding where to put their attention prior to seeing these series of images. And what we're interested in seeing is what happens to the perceptual responses when they see these types of images. In my laboratory, we're very interested in face processing. And we're very lucky because the brain has a very specific index or signature of face processing. And that's what I'd like to just show you here. I'm sure you've seen this funny-looking cap on many, many times before. It's recording the ongoing electrical activity in the brain. And, of course, this gives us exquisite timing in the order of thousandths of a second or millisecond. And it gives us the brain's electrical activity. There's a very characteristic fluctuation in the voltage that allows us to see the brain's response to a face 170 milliseconds after a face is presented. So faster than the snap of a finger, right? So when the brain sees a face, we get this component called the N170 component. And now our question is, what happens when we present that face house overlay, when they're attending to the face versus attending to the scene? Does it have any impact on this very fast perceptual response? And the answer is yes. So the key here is that what the participant sees is identical in both situations, a face house on top of each other. When they were attending to the face, as you can see in blue, the response is larger. The perceptual response is larger than when they're attending to the scene. And what does this mean? This means that even at the earliest stages of the brain's response to this stimulus, attention is having this profound effect to increase it. It's almost like the flashlight was brighter for the face, even though what they're seeing is exactly the same in both cases.
동발 간다 미국 대스타 간다 동보다 윤종원 강보다 니 바로 잘 돼요 봐. 갑가셔야 동발 미국 대쇼스 강보다 저를 돌아마셔스 갑가셔야 강보다 코유를 미는데 동발 돌아마셔서 동발 돌아체스 미국 대스라는 두가라 지당 안에서 레벨 나누려 미 동보 모신에 그 미세게 돼 누가 친구 여디인자 뒤 파르세데 시라체도 동발 따두가.
So this is a pretty basic study, right? We tell them what to pay attention to. We see what the response is. The question for me became, well, what about when it's not external environment, but what about our attention getting pulled away in the internal environment, in our own distracted mind? What happens to perception? Is it impacted by our internal mind wandering? Would be another way to describe it. So that's the question. What about internal distraction? Now, here's the tricky part as a psychologist, as a researcher. How do we do a study in which we would ask people to perform some task, but really what we're interested in is them wandering away from the task, right? We can't tell them to wander away because then they're actually doing what we ask them to do. We need them to distract their own mind away. And this is a little bit of a puzzle because how do you do this? After thinking about it for a while, what we realized is that all we have to do is make the task very, very boring. So, Your Holiness, I hope you're not having a lot of mind wandering right now.
So, but at this level, we're not making any distinctions between conceptual thought processes and perceptual processes.
So far, we have only talked about the impact on perception.
Perception.
Only, yeah. Right? Because it's so close in time to when the stimulus was presented.
Because the point His Holiness is making is, since we're interested in mental training, the training's effect is really at the level of thought and mind,
yes.
Not really at the level of perceptual processes.
That's the question, is what impact can we have on our perception just from thought and mind?
For
example, like when someone is in a pure, completely absorbed state of mind, whatever comes in the face of sensory perceptions, the person is not paying any attention. He's just completely focused. There is no attentiveness to what is within the sphere of the perception. And the point here is that when we are talking about mental training, the domain in which mental training occurs is really at the level of mind and thought, not at the level of perception.
So this is where I'm very happy to hear your view of that, because that is actually an open question within cognitive psychology. If you are absorbed, if your mind is so pulled away from the external environment, will it actually impact your perception? It's an open question. It's our subjective experience that we don't feel like we're seeing sights, we're not hearing sounds. But what we're wanting to do is see how the brain responds when our attention is pulled away from the external environment. That is exactly the question I'm asking. So I call it internal distraction here, but we could call it an internally absorbed state that is not attending to the external environment. Okay? But the key is that we're not telling them not to attend to the external environment. We're asking them to pay attention. So let me describe the task that we do, right? As I mentioned, in order to elicit mind wandering, to have them have their own distracted thoughts, because, Your Holiness, we're not at this point talking yet about mental training. I'd just like to lay out what we know from the broader literature, and then I would love to talk about the impacts of training on these very processes. But at the impact, at the level of how we perceive, what we want to do is see what happens when people are asked to do a task. We make it very boring. They mind wander away, and we see what the impact is on these early sensory processes. But the prediction you just made, based on what we know from absorptive states, is what motivates this. So what is the task? Again, like I said, we try to make it boring. All I'm going to ask for the participant is, every time you see a face on the screen, you press a button. That's it. Nothing complicated. Right? So this would get very boring after a while. The only interesting thing here is that sometimes the face will be upside down. Very easy to see it's upside down. In those cases, just don't press the button. Right? And what we do is play with the frequencies of how often the upside down button happens. So you just see a face, you press a button, press another button, don't press the button, press a button, right? So at some point, this becomes so boring for the participant that they begin having their own interesting internal dialogue. And the face comes up upside down and they will press the button when they shouldn't. Right. So the question is, what happens because of their own mind wandering? And we need some way to ask them. We need to know if they were mind wandering or not. So at some point, we stop the experiment and we just ask them on the screen, just now, right before you saw this screen, where was your attention? Was it on the task? Were you looking at the faces and remembering the task? Or was it off task, having some other thought? All right? And the question we want to know is, how does just being on task with your attention devoted to it or off task impact perception? And here's what we see. We see that when they're actually on task, the perceptual response is larger than when they are off task. So it's completely in line with what you were suggesting, is when attention is not aligned with the perceptual world, the perceptual system doesn't respond as strongly. It's as if sights, sounds, even touch is dimmed down, like the volume has been turned down.
So it's called inattentive perception, actually. There's a technical term for it.
This is why I love these conversations. So we, you know, you might say, okay, great, so they tell us if they're on task or off task. Should we trust that? These are just regular undergraduate students. Are they able to know if they were correctly on? Do they know their minds well enough to know if they were really on task or off task? If they truly were off task, then we'd expect some relationship with their performance, right? How they actually did on the task. And that is what we see. When they are off task, their accuracy on the task is reduced. And when they're on task, it's greater. So that tells us that, you know, there seems to be some truth to this. But I want to just point out, Your Holiness, that this is when we're asking them. They're not spontaneously reporting where their mind is. They're being asked. We call that a probe, right? We're probing their mind. And the probe is catching whether they're on task or off task. So one question we might have is, how able are they to spontaneously tell us if they're on task or off task, just on their own?
Yeah. 미 요결. 세상가 너돌이야. 에미 무슨 수 시기 무슨 수시 무슨 시험시에도 두 경기를 지면 돼. 가르는 코미 야지 그래서 돈을 벌어. 세상가 시바 원구 시바 니기 직불에 리드는 시. 다 예루디 지간 친 지부도 맞을 시.
So this reminds His Holiness of a story of his senior tutor, new monk who was abbot of Gyudim Monastery, but he had some deformity in his eyes. One eye was completely very squinted in a sort of sideways. Mm. So often Ling Rinpoche would say that when he sees the abbot, it feels as if the abbot is actually looking at him. And when he smiles back, he doesn't respond because one of his, probably his attention is gone into this other eye.
Exactly.
So here, what this really points out is almost like a, one could say, categorical distinction between processes that are, have to do with thought and mind and processes that are pure perception. And in fact, one could argue that when it comes to the perceptual processes, some of the animals may be even more acute compared to the human beings. But when it comes to the thought, human beings have a much greater ability because of the prefrontal cortex that we spoke.
So now I think it is very important, very important, you see, distinction. Kasa, Ombishabada.
It's on now.
Yeah.
It's on now. Your Holiness, it's on. It's good.
So this being able to make a distinction between perceptual processes and processes that has to do with thought and mind seems to be a really important thing.
So far, not much sort of pay attention about the distinction, sensorial level and mental level. So the other day I mentioned, when I mentioned the mental level, they immediately reject what Russian scientists, then Soviet Union, different. Now modern Russian, more open-minded.
So that's
the fundamental level. When we talk about consciousness, we have to make distinction, sensorial level and mental level. When we say training of mind, it's mental level, not sensorial. And then automatically, when your mind thinking seriously one thing, then the sensorial because of appearance there, but because of the
So it doesn't, lead to any form of ascertainment because you may have a perceptual experience, but if you don't pay attention, you won't be able to report that perception. There's no reportability.
All right.
So that, I think, like you, expert, I think now time come. You see, to educate people about consciousness, different level, sensorial level and mental level. So important is mental level. Anger, these come from mainly mental level.
Yes.
So when we talk about mind, including training of mind, you still no clear idea what is sensorial level, what's mental level. Then, Kasota, there is possibility of confusion.
Confusion.
So that's why So sometimes I express the Western psychologist and their knowledge about psychology, about mind. Compare ancient Indian psychology, Western psychology looks like kindergarten level.
I would agree with you.
So now that must improve through education, through information, and with help of the brain specialist. I think the brain, there are, I think, different location. the mental level, something seriously thinking, and sensory level experience. I think there are different.
Oh, absolutely.
So these are very important.
So may I suggest that what I'm showing here in this last slide is actually
this. Otherwise, you see, if you only use it thinking about sensory level, then better to ask some animal. Of course, we cannot communicate because no language. Otherwise, they know better.
But unfortunately, the problem is the sensory level is being impacted by the mind.
Yeah.
Absolutely impacted by the mind. If we are asked to do something very basic like read a book or look at another human being to see the expression on their face, but our thought is preoccupied with anger or distress, we're not actually picking up the information from the environment. Now, for many of the people that I work with, for example, students, or let's say surgeons, or let's say athletes, or people that are firefighters, police officers, for whom fully attending to the sensory environment can give you so much critical information. If now your own mind, your own concepts are pulling you away from that, your perception is compromised. That may be an obvious thing to us, that perception will be compromised when thought pulls us away. But the reason mind training becomes so important is that we need to allow them to have access to their own attention so they can fully perceive their environment. So I guess this to me is the hand-holding of perception and mind and mental content.
Well, one of the things that we know, Your Holiness, for example, is that centers in the brain which are important for emotion, for example, the amygdala, which we talked about yesterday, has a direct monosynaptic, meaning a very direct connection to the very first level of the visual system. And so this is a pathway by which our emotions can actually influence our sensory perception at the earliest stage of visual processing. So they are in the brain, there are ways in which the sensory and the mental are intimately connected.
That is exactly what I'm talking about.
So there seems to be some clarity, even from the brain perspective, yes, of the different processes.
And, you know, it's not even just the emotional side that will guide early perception. If I was thinking that I saw, let's say, just two dots and a line, if I thought that those two dots and a line was a face, I would get this kind of a face response. If I thought that those two dots and a line were tires and a log, I would not get that.
But that the dongbo yinbe dongbo re sambe na lamsa the mebo shu che de to jung yo re sa ta ya ji kolo ro jin de re sa ngo bu de re sa ya mebo shu chi ma chi bu me
so the sorry
kan da da ra ja yilo te ma de ga to na wang de I ke ban ru du sa de ta ra ja
so yeah. So I think what I would just like to emphasize is that the reason I'm showing you perception is because that's the earliest stages at which these top, what we call top-down or attentional influences or emotional influences can impact how we perceive the world. And that can be very problematic when it compromises our ability to perceive the world. I just want to end by saying that our ability to know when our mind has wandered, when we are off task, is not very good. If we ask people during this very boring task to just press a button every time that they notice their own mind wandered, they're very poor at it. In fact, we find that they respond much less often. What we call self-caught, when they press the button, they respond much less often than if we ask them. And this difference between
that makes sense. Yeah.
So I just want to wrap up by saying that part of our interest in offering mental training, like mindfulness meditation training, is to see if we can make that a little bit better so that our probing and people's own ability to notice their own mind wandering is better equated. And thankfully, what we're finding is that for these types of groups, when we offer such training, they are better able to notice their mind wandering and catch their mind wandering so that it doesn't have damaging effects. Thank you very much.
Let's make the transition.
So Solens would like to share a text which is on kind of, you know, Buddhist taxonomy of, you know, mental processes, which really kind of explains the taxonomy of sensory versus mental processes. And also in the second volume of Science and Philosophies in the Indian Buddhist Classics, there's a quite a large section on these topics. Yeah,
this is the one that's coming out.
That's coming out. John Dunn is editing. Yeah.
Sometimes I a little bit sort of reluctant to give that book. Mm-hmm. You see, it might get the impression, oh, show off.
So it's a little, he's a little reluctant because it may seem as showing off the Buddhist kind of insights and knowledge on the mind.
We already touched about mind. Now, if may I say so, you see, the ignorant about the mind, then these books are, I think, useful, helpful. So I may
share it now.
I may share it now. So these monks, they really spend the... They really, they spend a lot of time, hard work.
So Solon said that when he was officially inaugurating the four-volume series in Bodh Gaya, he said that, you know, hard work was done by these monks, but I took the credit.
So, Your Holiness, Sona will now talk about some of the applications in clinical context. And one of the really key insights is that for transformation of the mind to occur, we in the scientific world believe that meta-awareness is a very important element, and that if we have meta-awareness, and particularly if meta-awareness can be cultivated, it can be helpful in enabling people to actually transform their mind. So Sona will be talking about that topic.
Thank you. Wonderful. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. I feel very humbled to be speaking about this with you, and also very grateful. So I am a clinical psychologist and also a clinical researcher, and a lot of the work that I do focuses on teaching and studying the impact of contemplative practices in clinical settings, mostly with people who struggle with depression and who are vulnerable to depression. So I want to share a little bit of this work today in the hope that it might be, some of it may be of benefit as we think about what are the skills and capacities that are needed for children and for youth as we work to help them be mentally healthy today and also for future generations.
For example,
So when someone is experiencing, you know, deep depression, mm-hmm. the mind is at such a low state of mind that even though that person is exposed to quite attractive scenery or, yeah. you know, yeah. melodious tunes or, you know, delicious food, the person may not be interested at all because it's just so absorbed in this. So this shows that the sensory yes. processes and the mental processes are quite different.
So, the mental level is like compassion. Compassion brings forgiveness, tolerance. You see, these some experience in mental level there, then scenery, very awful, or music, very sort of disturbing. But the person's sort of mental state can remain calm. Is that any of that?
That's definitely possible.
But you do what you should just on. Now I have a drum mini for most of it. Same with Nane, the cook, the castle, the city, you know, that chances the servers in the day, Yamme. Then I'm not going to do it. She was that day, those go city dead is done. Oh, come in, shave a pretty information.
It's very clear that if someone has a depth of tranquility or calmness in one's mind, and a lot of these will be a kind of a function of cultivating compassion mm-hmm. and deep sense of forgiveness, loving kindness, and so on. And for the Buddhist, the understanding of emptiness is an important a part of that. For such an individual, even though he or she may be
mentioned. Quantum physics also have to neutralize also the extreme view, good or bad.
Mm-hmm. So this person may...
Just so the subject of so the education.
Education.
Not religion.
So this person may be exposed to a very, very difficult environment, but the environment, the vulnerability to the environment will be much less. Such a person will be able to maintain his or her composure.
That is actually a very beautiful description of what people experience when they are depressed, just as you stated. And it is the reason that we work with people who have been depressed in the past and are relatively well, but they're vulnerable to that depth that you described coming back. And they're eager to learn different ways of working with their minds that will help to prevent that depression from coming back. One of the ways we do this work is with the practice of mindfulness meditation.
You can leave it in the middle, yeah?
Test I on think, it tomorrow.
I think we should leave it in the middle and then people will get copies. Yeah.
Those people, you see, who have some interest, then copy available. And which price? $100.
Good idea.
I think that's probably money very well spent.
Mixing with capitalist people. We also now have to think about money.
So one of the ways we do this work is with mindfulness meditation, which many people connected with mind and life have been part of bringing to Western clinical contexts, like Jon Kabat-Zinn and people who are here with us today, like Tara Goleman and Jack Kornfield. I'm going to be talking... in particular about this intervention called mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, which combines mindfulness meditation with cognitive behavioral therapy, which I think you know well. I think you know cognitive behavioral therapy well from your conversations with Aaron Beck. And it's taught as in a group of people for 8 sessions. And the mindfulness practice starts with, as you were saying, very tangible sensory experiences, paying attention to the sensations of eating something or sensations in the body. But then over time, as you can see here, the object of attention moves to the mental. So as I was saying, as it moves over time to the from things like the sensations of eating to difficult thoughts and difficult emotions. And it's important, I think, to know that this program, this course, has been studied in many different countries with many different people. And my work in particular focuses on women during pregnancy and mothers with little babies. And we teach this to women who've been depressed in the past and want to learn these skills to stay well when they're pregnant and when they're new mothers. You can see from this graph that's shown on the screen, this is a graph that shows the proportion of people who stay well over time. And this is through when their babies are 6 months old. And we can see here that the mothers who got this 8-week class, MBCT, I'll refer to it as, that 80% of them stayed well and didn't have depression come back while they were pregnant and until their babies were 6 months old, compared to only 50% of those women who have what we refer to as usual care, which unfortunately in our country and many other countries means very little to no care at all for their mental well-being. We pay a lot of attention in this world, in many countries, to the physical health of mothers, but not so much to their mental well-being. So these findings are important because in their own right, they tell us that these practices can help support mothers in ways that are good for their mental health and that we think help them also be warm and responsive to their babies. But they're also important because once we know that a program works, we can start to ask questions about how does it work. It reminded me when you were speaking the other day of liking to figure out how mechanical objects work. So if we have, say, that clock and we know that it works, we can start to look inside and say, what are the pieces and how do they fit together? One of the areas of focus has been on this topic of meta-awareness. Now, for people who do the type of research that I do, the definition of meta-awareness includes the mind-wandering of focus and awareness that Amishi was talking about, but is also expanded to be awareness of your thoughts and feelings, but not identifying with them, not distorting them, and with a spirit of kindness for yourself. One of the reasons that this is important in depression is because these are the kinds of thoughts that often occur. Thoughts like, I'm so weak, or I'm a failure, or I'm no good. Thoughts that can be very painful for people.
No, I also experience, I'm so tired. So many programs now reduce like that. And also long flights from here to America, now canceled. To Europe, I'm trying, but I don't know. Okay.
That's why the 9 hours of sleep is very important. We want you to be well. One of the metaphors that we use with women that they often find helpful is to notice their thoughts like leaves on a stream, so that they don't get carried away down the stream. So this is a little grainy, but this is water with rocks and leaves. And the... So if we think of a mother with a little baby, maybe, who's crying and hard to soothe, and the thought comes, am I doing this right? To notice that thought, as opposed to identifying with it and having then the next thought, I don't know what I'm doing. Other people know how to do this, but I don't. I'll never know how to do this right. And being pulled down that river of thinking. So science is just starting to examine this process, and I'll share with you just one result from one study. But a lot of the ways that people measure this right now is by asking people to report on their own inner state. So they ask people to read and respond to questions like these that are on the screen. I notice that I don't take difficulty so personally. I can treat myself kindly. I can observe unpleasant feelings without being drawn into them. And these other ones, this capacity to view things from a wider perspective.
So
what this shows is that the way in which mind works is just there are so many interdependent factors.
Yes,
one
true.
Triggers the other, and one is dependent yes. upon other.
Hygiene of emotion. Oh, the basic for your mental state is sound. Now, then the sensorial level, some disturbance come.
You recover quickly.
Oh, not disturbed. Like, I think, this how much to I'm your teacher. Like, you see, your physical basic sort of also the element of what? Huh? I think a mental level, physical level. I think the whole system, the way, because of the system of Jodan, I think quite similar. Physical level, your basic sort of body, or say the
constitution,
has what a good 가서다.
Good health.
Good health. Then some virus come. Mm-hmm. Will not disturb much. Mm-hmm. Your basic physical condition weak. And a small virus really disturb. Similarly, mental level, the basic your mental
state of mind.
Mental state firm or healthy. And then information through sensorial level cannot disturb much. Isn't it?
Yes.
The basic level, too much sensitive or weak, then small, so also the information, something much disturbed. Yeah. So now, therefore, training of mind should not consider as a religious practice, but a healthy life. Mm-hmm.
Mental health. Lam.
Oh. And then the healthy body also related with that.
Yes.
Like that. So in this respect, I think scientists have, as they, I think, can do more. Mm-hmm. Educate people. Everybody take care about their physical health as well as mental health. Not relying on religion or meditation or something, mm-hmm. yoga. Mm-hmm. Simply thinking. So I think, you have, I think, very, very important rule. And therefore, because the important rule, you also have more responsibility to build healthy world, happy world. Not through prayer. I think we human beings pray to God, to Buddha, over 1,000 years. The result? Not much significant. the scientific way explain that, I think, bring convictions.
Yeah, what? I can see it.
Conviction.
Oh.
Oh. So change mind, conviction is important. Just mere knowledge will not affect our emotion. Real conviction. Yesterday, you see, we discussed, firstly, hearing. Then think of that more so critical way.
Critical way.
Then eventually, in that respect, I think it is very important to know different views. This view say that. This view say that. Very important. Just believe one, not good. So different
perspectives. Different perspectives.
Now some Buddhist ancient Nalanda masters writing. You see, they mentioning, although they wrote by Buddhist and for Buddhist people, but mentioned all existing different philosophy or viewpoint. It's immense help to analyze, to invest, because the
learn it, to awaken, one's critical thinking.
So once, and so the musician got there, lubuchuna kajisari shigyomari.
Because if you don't use critical faculty, then you become someone who could be easily led in any direction by others.
Yes.
That brings conviction. It's not just get some information, one book, one teaching, one holy lama, just believe that. not sufficient. We must analyze. So I think that respect, I think Nalanda master, I think really wonderful. They, even Buddha's own word, they investigate. If you accept this Buddha's teaching literally, it creates contradiction. Therefore, we must reject. It's good, isn't it?
Yes.
So through that way, conviction come. Conviction familiarize often. That we call meditation. Then gradually, without thinking reason, but simply, you remember that immediately you get some feeling.
Now, spontaneous. Spontaneous.
Oh, spontaneous. Now that gradually affects our emotion, mm-hmm. our wrong views. Mm-hmm. So this, I think, truly training our mind.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Not thinking about next life, not thinking of heaven or nirvana. Indian term, nirvana, moksha. Not thinking that. Simply, the day-to-day life, more calm person, more happy person. And then, one calm person, happy person, share with more people. And then each share more people. And from one person, 10 person, 100 person, 1,000 person, 100,000. That's the way to change humanity's way of thinking, way of life. Isn't it?
I totally agree.
So scientists, I think, are very, very... if, you see, some occasion come, I want to put one scientist put on my throne, teach. Better. We just, you see, repeat. 1,000 years, certain concept, repeat. Not much helpful.
We actually talk about this intervention sometimes like a vaccination for your mental state to help protect you from those kind of viruses in the future, that it helps to do that. I'll just end very briefly with just actually the first line of a poem that's one of my favorite poems. Which is here. It's by the first poet laureate of Arizona, and it's called When Giving Is All We Have. And the first line says, one river gives its journey to the next. And this is to say to Your Holiness that we hold this responsibility as scientists, and the way in which we can contribute to the benefit of humanity very deeply.
So, wonderful.
Thank you very much.
So now we will take a 15-minute tea break and then return. Thank you. Okay, we are going to begin now, and we will begin with a presentation from Tipton Jimbala, who will step out of his role as translator and provide a Buddhist perspective on attention and meta-awareness.
Thank you, Your Holiness, colleagues, and guests. I'm deeply honored to have this opportunity to offer a very brief presentation offering the Buddhist perspective on the topic of attention and meta-awareness. I have chosen for my presentation the writings of actually one Buddhist master, 8th century Buddhist master by the name of Shantideva. And the reason why I chose this is that in Shantideva's book, there is a whole chapter on what he calls guarding awareness or applying meta-awareness. And the reason why I chose this is because, you know, the last 2 days and today we have been talking about how to promote pro-social behavior through social emotional learning and secular ethics education. So we have a kind of a goal. And the idea here is bringing some kind of pro-social behavior among the children. And so in Shantideva's case, what he's interested in is to... What he's interested in is to really provide a framework and set of discipline and practices for his monastic colleagues who are dedicated to living a life to the ideal, according to the ideal of altruism, so compassion and altruism, and based on that has observed certain, accepted certain precepts. So he wants to develop a discipline and system by which the monastics who are committed to this way of life can actually do this efficiently without exercising conscious will all the time. Because he understands that if you rely on exertion of will all the time, it doesn't really work. You need to have a system by which there is a discipline. So now, of course, the term like mindfulness and meta-awareness really goes all the way back to the early days, to the Buddha himself. There is a very famous sutta, a discourse called Satipatthana Sutta.
And then here, I have some sort of views. Buddha himself, because of protection survey, from Indian tradition.
It's a product of Indian tradition.
So the Indian tradition, before Buddha, already certain strong tradition or training of mind already there. So Buddha, the 6 years fasting, I don't think just fasting and remain there. No, meditation. So these, before Buddha come, these practice already exist in this country. So Buddha was Kasota production.
A product of this tradition.
Indian rich tradition, not started by Buddha, but before that, I think at least before Buddha, I think 1,000 years, I think already there. So now I usually say consider the messenger of ancient Indian thought. So I want to say Indian tradition is Kasota greater than Buddha.
So you can see that in a sense we're doing a joint presentation here. unlike other presentations, mine is not to His Holiness. It's really to my colleagues and the guest here to really establish a basis for conversation, to provide the Buddhist perspective. Because these are, when we are talking about these mental faculties like attention, mindfulness, and meta-awareness, these are key, if we can call it, active ingredients that are part of the mental training processes. And because of this long history, His Holiness was saying that in India, it goes all the way to 3,000 years, even 1,000 years before the Buddha, there was a lot of attention and mental training. So there was a much more reflective attention paid to what those processes involve. So you can see here, this is Satipatthana Sutta from the Pali Canon. And here we read, here monks, in regard to the body, a monk abides contemplating the body, diligent, clearly knowing, which is sometimes translated also as fully aware, and mindful, free from the desires and discontent in regard to the world. So the idea here is a monk who is living according to a sound ethical discipline, has no remorse and guilt, has a sort of a joyful state of mind, then is now applying the mind, paying attention to the body processes within the body, fully aware and retaining that attention. That really is the image that you have here. And the key terms here is mindfulness, smriti, and so here I think we need to, I need to introduce a note of caution because the way in which this term mindfulness is used in contemporary literature is quite different from the way in which it is understood in the classical tradition. And here, mindfulness is really understood as a kind of a faculty. It's understood as a faculty. Not when we talk about the practice of mindfulness, then the term is used satipatthana or smriti prajnana, which is really applying or placing mindfulness. So that is what, in modern terminology, they use the mindfulness for that. But here, mindfulness is more of a faculty. And the key aspect of that is retaining one's attention to a chosen object. So as Amishi pointed out, the key element of attention is to choose the focus, and mindfulness is what helps you retain that focus. So that's the faculty. And meta-awareness, which is samprajnana in Sanskrit and sheshin in Tibetan, is a little different because it's a sort of an observing an ongoing process within one's body and mind. So there is a kind of it's very similar to what Amishi...
Body, mind, speech.
And speech as well. So it's really, the key effect here is there is a kind of it's a current processes. It's an observation of a current you know, present moment processes. And there is, and one thing that it became, you know, kind of common theme between Amishi's definition and Sona's definition and mine presenting from the Buddhism is that there is an understanding that meta-awareness involves some second-order processes. Attention is first order, and meta-awareness is the second order. So I think that is, the term meta is a technical term, but I think this second order, higher order, is a good way of thinking about it. So this is really goes all the way back to the Buddha, but of course these terms and ideas and gets concepts gets a bit more fine-tuned. And in Shantideva, there's this beautiful line, sorry, he says, I make this plea with my palms folded to those who wish to guard their mind. With all your effort, guard mindfulness and awareness. And in the Tibetan translation, it says, even at the cost of your life. But in the Sanskrit version, is this. So the idea here is there's kind of a... The aim, ultimate aim here is to help the monastic member to find a way to observe and guard their ethical precepts without too much effort. And you do that by guarding the mind. And you guard the mind by applying mindfulness and meta-awareness. So you can see there's a process. The ultimate aim is to help guard the precepts so that you live according to the precepts that you have abide by. And here is really the altruistic ideal. And then you do that by observing and guarding your mind. And that guarding of your mind is done by applying mindfulness and meta-awareness. So this... And then what exactly is meta-awareness? And Shantideva has a beautiful definition. He says, in brief, this alone is the definition of guarding your awareness, the observation at every moment of the state of your body and your mind. So you can see it's an active process, present moment process, and it's really observing. So, and then there's another one where he says, if mindfulness stands at the entrance of the mind's door to guard it, the awareness will arise. Even when lost, it will come back. So what you have here is this idea that the primary role of the mindfulness, meta-awareness, is really to guard. And the idea here is that our mind, our senses, and our mind is the doors through which we interact with the world. And if we can somehow stand as a guard at the entrance of that door, you can then regulate and choose to live according to your own values and aspirations. That really is the idea. So, so what is interesting about this is that we see there are two aspects to meta-awareness. One is, or we can say two types or two aspects. One is meta-awareness as a monitoring awareness. So here, very similar to what you were talking about, what Amishi was talking about. It's a kind of a, you know, monitoring of a present moment processes, body, speech, and mind. So its role is to monitor. So it's proactive, it's consciously applied, and it's effortful. So you have to consciously apply it, shishin temba. There is another aspect or type of meta-awareness, which is in fact better captured as a self-awareness. And this is something that really arises as a consequence. You know, it's effortless. So the idea here is that if you pay attention to a chosen object, you retain that attention by applying mindfulness. You protect your mindfulness by applying meta-awareness, monitoring awareness. Then through this habituation, you develop a habit where when you are confronted with a challenging situation, awareness will kick in. That, I think, is the key here. So here you have meta-awareness more as a active monitoring processes and meta-awareness as a consequent, resultant awareness. So we need to somehow find a way to capture both of these roles. And in both of these cases, the second order dimension is there. That, I think, is what unites the two. But the difference is, one is a condition for strengthening mindfulness. The other one is a consequence of mindfulness. So you can see it's very interdependent. It's not just a one kind of, you know, unidirectional causal relationship. So, of course, this Shantideva's kind of, you know, ideas are embedded in a larger psychology, which identifies specific faculties. So, for example, when you are confronted with the object, the factor that turns attention is referred to as the intention, and you know, and then you are confronted with all this mass of information. Attention is what selects. Mindfulness is what retains it, you know, sustains it, and meta-awareness is what guards that mindfulness. So you see, these are functionally defined aspects of the mental process. Each has a different function, and it is through the combination and reinforcement of each other that the training is supposed to occur. So it's a sort of a... this is actually, you know, embedded in a... It has a larger theory of behavior change. You know, in the end, just like the proponents of social-emotional learning and secular ethics education, we're interested in some kind of behavior change, you know, albeit through a voluntary process, not imposed. But we are interested in a behavior change, which is the promotion of pro-social behavior. And here, Shantideva is interested in, you know, promotion of bodhisattva, you know, act, you know, precepts. So you have, so he has a theory of change where, you know, the first you have to know, you know, pros and cons of doing something. So if you're, for example, thinking of learning to meditate, first you need to know what are the pros and cons. You need to know it that beneficial. Once you recognize it's beneficial, then you feel attracted to it. Then you appreciate it. You become interested. And when you are interested, you pay attention. So we know that. When we are interested in something, we pay attention. And once you start paying attention, then you apply mindfulness to sustain that attention, that you don't lose it. And that mindfulness is sustained by applying meta-awareness. So this three starts integrating with each other. So there's a kind of a process which then leads to more enthusiasm, because the more you do it, the more you enjoy it, and there's enthusiasm kicks in, which then helps to exercise effort. You know, this is not a kind of a grinding the teeth kind of effort. This is a much more motivated effort. And then effort leads to action. And if you do, you know, action, if you keep doing it, you have a joy. And joy is crucial for sustaining motivation. It's one thing to motivate it initially, but if you don't find a joy or a sense of fulfillment, many of us know that on the first day of a new year, we all make resolutions, especially for me, going to gym, and I go for a few days, and then I don't do it. So, and many of us know, because we get motivated initially, but to sustain that motivation, you need to have a sense of fulfillment or joy. That's what sustains it. And then, in this way, if you do more and more, and habit is formed, and once habit is formed, it becomes second nature to you, then it becomes effortless. That His Holiness was talking about how, you know, from received knowledge of just understanding and hearing, when you apply critical, you know, thinking and internalize that knowledge, you develop deep conviction, and the more you do it, at some point it becomes second nature to you and become part of your habit, then it effortlessly it comes out. So that is really the sort of what I wanted to present to show that, you know, I think here my own feeling is there is a fruitful area of collaboration between what Buddhist, you know, mental science has to offer, particularly the contemplative practice field has to offer, because at this point, meta-awareness is a new construct in science, and I think the more there can be dialogue, the more I think the concepts will become clearer and clearer. And also this whole usage of the term mindfulness, you know, the way in which contemporary researchers use versus the way in which classical sources use, if we at least know the distinction, it will make a lot of difference. Thank you.
I feel
So in fact, you know, His Holiness was making the important point that when we talk about mindfulness and awareness, meta-awareness, even animals are, you know, thought so to possess, them.
Nothing to do with religion. Actually, for survival, the animal, you see, once they realize some danger, they are sort of
Their attention is very acute.
Oh.
And then they retain that attention.
So I think this is the part of mind, and mainly the mental level, for survival. So now in religious context, according to certain practice, in order to focusing that particular point more,
single-pointedly.
And then analytical meditation also, you see, very important, the tension you would.
So analytical meditation also, the application of mindfulness and awareness is very, very important.
So that is the since many years, see, I just expressed the part of brain which, you see, develop the appreciation. The reason when my mood okay, then I give blood to mosquito. So then mosquito enjoy my blood, and then their body, whole body become red, and then fly. No sign of appreciation. So I'm wondering, the brain size, which size have the ability to show appreciation? So now similarly, the kazajut tension.
Yeah, mindfulness and awareness. Oh, yeah.
Very, very tiny insect, I don't know.
And I think particularly meta-awareness, I think, is only likely present in just a few species besides humans.
Isolens was making the point that although the definitions and the actual systematic presentation of these are in the context of a contemplative practice, we mustn't. We should remember that we are talking about natural mental processes could be present in animals.
For survival.
No, I understand that.
For survival.
I'm simply raising the question about the extent to which meta-awareness itself is present in different species. And the likelihood is that it's present in a number of other species besides humans, but not that many. That meta-awareness is a very complex... process, and certainly it's very unlikely, based on everything we know about the brain, that it's present in, for example, rodents, more likely primates.
And when they
in womb conception,
and the gizhi to yad.
So this reminds
his
holiness of another point, which is in Buddhist, in a conception of fetal development, it's quite similar to the scientific idea that, you know, over time, the fetus developed various kind of, you know, protrusions of the limbs. And then at one point, the sensory organs kind of emerge. So is there any study that is done on when the senses are fully formed in fetus? As well as he would expect mindfulness to be there as a faculty, but
it seems
maybe not meta-awareness.
It seems temporary.
So he would assume the mindfulness to be
very
present.
Simple brain, maybe some past experience, later
may remember that.
Remember that.
So, Chambadi, she does cover sometimes.
So, he would expect the meta awareness to be a bit more developed, kind of later development.
Yes. And
so, that's some relation with intelligence.
Literally.
And that,
can I ask you a clarification? May I have my mic?
Yes.
A clarification. Microphone. A clarification about the term mindfulness.
Yeah.
Okay, now it's on. Okay. Because I think it's important for us to make that distinction, right? So in the way that you're describing smriti, we would say that that's something like working memory. So the ability to, once information has been selected, to hold that in an active state in mind, right? So the, and when we're talking regarding meta-awareness, it's the guarding of the information that's currently held to ensure that our goals, actions, behaviors are, our behavior is aligned with our goals,
yes,
in some sense. So when Your Holiness, you were talking about different species and their survival being based on meta-awareness, in some sense, it may be the goal of, have I eaten? Have I received the food that I need? So that's a goal that they would hold. Mm. But I would argue that it's really unique to humans to have abstract concepts be held in working memory to guide behavior. So the notion of fairness, or let's just use fairness as an example, to hold that in working memory to guide behavior.
I think dogs, some birds, you see, they know the person treat them honest or some different aim. If you want to catch them and feeding, or they already know, or the person feeding them not very sincere. Mm-hmm. If you're feeding them very sincere, they are added to something different. So they also have some knowledge.
They seem to have some ability to distinguish between whether we're being honest or mm-hmm. not.
Would that guide their behavior?
Yes. Yeah. But wouldn't you... So he's ready to run away if he's suspicious. Mm-hmm. But wouldn't you agree that even in an animal, there would be some ability to monitor what's going on in the surrounding area?
Yeah, absolutely.
So this monitoring awareness role would be there.
I think in terms of monitoring the mind itself,
But I mean, the meta awareness need not necessarily be just focused on the mind. It's a bodily processes as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think this is quite helpful to wake up if some audience go like that. I think it's terrible. I think animal sensorial sort of experience is more stronger, more important for their survival, not mental level.
Mental level.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So the memory experience on a physical level may be more stronger. Mental level, because of
course, they will have less.
Mental level, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that's clear is that there are signals from the body that can be monitored by the brain in many other species, but the extent to which those animals are aware of those signals, that's really the critical question. And there are parts of the brain that we know are important for monitoring the body. And there are very big changes over the course of evolution in those parts of the brain. And so it's certainly clear that many different animals use information from the body to guide their behavior, but the question is whether they're aware of that information.
Okay.
And that's
now this brings the question, the memory Which part of the brain?
The insula. The insula is for the body, to monitor the body.
But
for creation of memory is the hippocampus. But the entirety of the brain actually can hold memories.
The creation, formation of memory, the hippocampus. So there is,
it's like the record button.
So the hippocampus.
There's a difference between.
So His Holiness was asking when it comes to the formation of memory, which is in hippocampus, can one make a distinction between whether or not memories are more formed predominantly through experiences of the mind versus senses?
Yeah, the input.
Temple so talkback and roma da.
Re temple anda talkback and re.
Oh, jazanga.
Re. Ta ine yang wan she ge yang yo.
Oh, she be kan le ji. Ta ka so chwa ti du ti yor wa da. Chwa ti du. Ta di yi lu ga ne, temple di yi lu ga ne yo mo da. Wo bi she ko ta ka shi na.
Wan she ko ran da temple sha tu ga yo.
Sensory memories and memories of concepts are stored in different locations in the brain. At least to a large extent. So our sensory memories, memories of, for example, a painting, which is visual, would be stored in visual areas of the brain, whereas memories of music would be stored in auditory areas of the brain. So based on the sensory channel, it would be stored in different locations in the brain.
That's why I was going to ask Your Holiness what you meant by the mind.
When you made
the distinction between the sensory information and information from the mind, what type of information were you talking about with respect to the mind?
So there is this understanding in Buddhist epistemology. So this whole distinction between perception versus mental is part of a Buddhist epistemology that really makes a distinction between the way in which these two processes engage with the world differently. In the case of perception, it's more direct. There's almost a kind of a mirroring type of there's a kind of a greater totality. You know, when your visual experience in confronted with what is in front of you is more total and it's immediate and it's direct. But when we move on the level to the level of the thought, then there is a selection that is involved. And the selection would involve selecting out and ignoring, excluding out all sorts of information. And then that exclusion process leads to a kind of a conflation of a concept with the object that you have perceived. Therefore, even after you have seen this and this jar has been taken away, you can have a mental image of this jar. Whereas for the senses, the presence of perception of mental image, perception of the jar would necessitate the presence of that jar in front of you. Whereas having the image of the one wouldn't require.
So this is where I think it's an interesting distinction, not distinction, but connection. Because if I close my eyes and I think of His Holiness's face and I'm holding it in mind, I'm activating parts of my brain that are part of the sensory hardware that is used to perceive his face. And there's an overlap between them. So is that a mind object or is that a sensory object? Because it is the same group of neurons that have learned to hold that representation that become active when I think of His Holiness's face.
Sensory information 땡에서 좀 하다. 그 그게 뒤지서 그래. 잠깐 쓴데겠지. 또 먹고 나.
So the sensory modalities are really seen as doors through which you get that sense, sure. sensory information.
Yeah.
And the thought does all the interpretation and imposition of categories mm-hmm. and concepts. So this is where the mindfulness and memory would kick in at that level, not at this initial.
Right.
Not at this initial kind of, you know, confrontation with the object. But it's only, you know, it could be very fast, you know, when you move to the thought level. But the selection takes place. There's a conflation of the, you know, sensory image with the mental image, so that even when you close, the image can still remain. Close your eyes, the image can still remain. So by that time, it's a very fast process, this, but you're already at the level of thought because interpretation has kicked in. Mm-hmm. You know, interpretation based on categorization, and all of this has kicked in.
But what I was saying in my presentation, and I'll let you have the floor, is just that even in perception, it kicks in.
Right.
지 카도세 핀데 그 체크라다 토닝 요 말고
네.
저때 그 튕지 깨제 토네. 튕지 슬러샤 이기로.
네.
가
달레도 빌레.
어.
So this raises an interesting question and the question has been raised in the Buddhist text epistemological text about congenital blindness. Can they have concepts of physical objects?
They clearly do.
They clearly do. So that's the answer that the Buddhist texts have given. It's they clearly do. They can have. Yeah. But I think the part of the tension here, I think we can discuss in the afternoon. Yeah. Probably has to do with the way in which the term perception is defined.
Yeah.
I think we should bracket this for the afternoon and we can report back to you tomorrow, Your Holiness, about what we discover. But I'd like to bring this back to the central theme of this whole week, which is really about our children and about development. And one of the intuitions that motivated our inclusion of this day is that meta-awareness is a very important ingredient for change. And in the programs that we saw featured yesterday, there were specific strategies that were presented to cultivate meta-awareness in our children. And as well as in the individuals who are caring for our children. And so one question which we have for you, Your Holiness, is whether there is anything that we can glean from Buddhist understanding about when this faculty actually develops over the course of human development. That's the first question. And the second question is, how early is it reasonable to actually begin to use whatever strategies, analytic meditation, or whatever the strategies might be, to begin to cultivate this in young children? Nothing that comes to His Holiness's mind, but I think it does underline the importance of Buddhist scholars sitting down with a scientist and also try to sort of correlate the fetal development and the stages of, you know, development of the fetus. The emergence of sensory modalities and experience and so on, and how that maps with the scientific understanding, and also at a young age, at what point these faculties can kick in. But other than that, he doesn't have any.
That's anyway. 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 딱 들어가서 박자하세요.
네. 그래.
그다. 맞아. 체조의 박자가 체면이야. 근데 용구도 가시.
네.
어. 다 가서 집에 체면이 있게 좀
좀. 네. 네.
다리 간서 셔나. 체면의 박자가 더 잡아 두고.
네.
어, 참아. 내가 그 가서 그게 고급 찍고 좀 있네. 찍디. 야. 뭐 삼동단 면장이 되고. 다 대통 아주 몸의 박자 내가 저 이도 시켜 드리.
So one thing that is at the disposal of the Buddhist explanatory system is the concept of what is referred to as the imprint or disposition. Sometimes it's how it's translated. So in the case of, you know, we had been exposed to the study of twins and the even differences between the behavior of monozygotic twins who share the same genes, then so the Buddhists, you know, would invoke that part of the explanatory, resource, which is to talk about imprints coming from previous lives. So even in this life, what happens in the early part of your life, you know, leaves imprints, which then manifest in your latter part of your life. So this whole concept of imprint is somewhat similar to disposition, but it's not the same things. But these are, and in the Buddhist case, you know, it'll be traceable, you know, before the birth itself. But of course, that is outside the domain of science. So there was a story of a very, very young infant who was able to read Tibetan before he was formally taught. So he was born in Amdo and the reincarnation of a Geshe. But His Holiness was curious to see if some studies could be done. But of course, it's much more complicated to have access.
순주간에 그 일로 하시는지다. 지금 술에 찍기지하라. 순주간에 아주 별로야 신자들. 지금 순주간에 교대는지.
He was also able to recite certain texts that, you know, one would have normally memorized, but much later.
So that is mysteries.
So these are mysteries.
Some phenomenon there. So we have to find reason.
Yes. Explanation.
Then,
So if you choose to use take recourse to the concept of rebirth, then it makes your life a little easier.
That also very complicated. You see, according to theistic religion, this very life created by God. So a little difficult.
Sonny, did you have something?
I wanted to ask you if you, in early, when you talked about the guarding function, you talked about guarding two functions of guarding the ethical precepts, I think, and guarding the mind. So, in this theory of behavior change, in what ways is that ethical precepts, can you talk a little bit about how attention to ethics is part of this process of behavior change? And when we separate and only focus on the guarding of the mind without also focusing on the guarding of the ethics, what might be lost there?
I think this is set into the within the larger context of intention and values. So that is not included here because I was simply interested in the mechanism of these processes. And this is a conversation we had recently, you know, this instrumentalism versus having a larger container. But in this case, intention is a key component, and intention tied to a value which involves having a deep admiration for all the precepts. So that's ethics is really the foundation. And even in the Buddha's Satipatthana Sutta, you can see ethics was the foundation because it says a monk who has no discontent in relation to the world. So he's talking about a man who lives ethically sound life, so there's no remorse and guilt, with a sense of joy, and then engages in applying the mind. So ethics is really the foundation in all of these.
The ethics, I think the definition level, you know, then
but of course, how do you define ethics and ethicality of an action, good or bad? Then that would, you know, it would differ also, from system to system.
Also related with different, I say there,
tradition, religious traditions as well.
You know, so I think we have to sort of, Kasota, when we talk about for humanity. Not this group or that group. So, without touching religion, use common sense. In that field, the scientists are very important. So, therefore, the Chuludan Jedewe Tanya Zedering as the Kukusha Pajamari.
So, you know, what is helpful to is to remember. You know, as much as possible, kind of turn away from specific terminology that is tied to a specific religious tradition.
Mm-hmm.
But when, on the other hand, they said when we are talking about the taxonomies of the mind, then we have no choice at this point but to rely on the Buddhist texts.
Oh. This also one.
Tibetan.
Okay.
May I ask
Yes.
I'd like to ask a question. So, you know, all of these, all of the guidance and the framework, even the notion of using the term guiding the mind, has in it, implicit in it, an understanding that the mind will misbehave.
Yeah.
And I'd like to hear a little bit about your thoughts on that. What is the understanding of why the mind wanders in the first place?
Nami lo nami ang shugo dogo ay kinsen kari nas. Tatu su te shego na sem sumo at sem sumo kaje mami shego ro. Tisa sem di tatu su gu tege mabu si.
Pagi yulu tala pa yun sa de chuni gu ko sa isto wa tala chuni ro.
Well,
shiba siri yu de kare chuni ro.
There's one Buddhist explanation which says that that's the way it is. So this is part of a serious, actually, conception of reality. When you explain a phenomenon, the explanatory process has to eventually come to an end. It cannot be a kind of an infinite process. So it will come to an end where you simply don't have an explanation. You say, that's the way it is. Why are there things in the world? You just say, that's the way it is. So then that becomes a law of nature on which then you start identifying the connections between things, phenomena, and then it's a kind of a relationship, dependent relationship, law, because some phenomena are more suited in connecting with others. On that basis, then you begin to see the specific functions of different phenomena. Mm-hmm. And then taking into account what is the first law, which is called the law of nature, that's the way it is, plus the principle of dependence and principle of function, then you use the principle of evidence, because X... why happens. Mm-hmm. So the whole causal reasoning and any form of reasoning presupposes that you have these laws.
Well, I think from a scientific perspective, in thinking about mind wandering, very young infants and probably very primitive species, I would say, are very unlikely to have mind wandering. Because they are responding in the moment to whatever is in front of them.
Yes.
Their attention and their behavior is driven by what we would say is stimulus-driven, driven by the external environment. But we have the capacity for thinking. we have the capacity for imagining the future and reflecting on the past.
That's right.
And it is that capacity which confers the ability for our minds to wander. And so I think that mind wandering only emerges at a certain point in human development when that capacity emerges. So probably in a six-month-old baby, I don't think they have any mind wandering. I think that...
Show your mercy.
That can't be true.
We don't know. Hard to ask them.
So for
example, like mata machine de namien semar tempo pa poro.
Cuz sim, tege anda ame omo du dung de ti yengro.
So I think there's a problem here, mind wandering versus distraction. Would you say that a six-month-old baby is susceptible, vulnerable to distraction?
Distraction?
Yes, very much so. Yes, very much so. So the mind
wandering,
because he's also saying that, for example, if a four-month-old baby is sucking the milk of a mother, and if there's a loud noise, it's
absolutely
going to shift the attention.
But the definition of mind wandering is where the mind is placed on an object that is not what is in front of it. It's something in its mind, so to speak.
But it may be, for example, we do see among individuals some differences. Some people are kind of not very curious, and they don't think a lot. And then these people probably have less mind wandering. And some people are very restless, but they're very curious, and then their mind might be wandering everywhere. So it's probably a function of intelligence as well.
And curiosity.
So there's a difference among even individuals.
Yes. Our time has come to an end, so lunchtime. Thank you so much, Your Holiness. We're deeply grateful for your time.
Thank you. See you again tomorrow. Thank you.